Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Congress passed a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill this week, sending money out to address a wide swath of pandemic-related issues, including reopening schools.
That's a big part of this bill, and that's a big priority for President Biden.
We talked to Senator Chris Coons about the relief package and what it means for Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from Senator Tom Carper about the COVID relief bill and other issues he's tackling in Washington. Arts Playlist previews a new exhibition at the Delaware Art Museum. And Enlighten Me updates us on UD research on salt marshes and their impact on carbon in the atmosphere. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The $1.9 trillion federal COVID relief bill is now law. After the Senate passed its version last week, the House approved that revised plan and sent it to President Joe Biden for his signature. The package offers $1,400 direct payments to many Americans, expands the child tax credit for a year, and extends federal unemployment benefits into early September. It also sends billions of dollars out to address vaccine production and distribution, assist state and local governments, reopen schools, and boost small businesses, especially restaurants. Earlier this week, we caught up with Delaware's junior senator, Chris Coons, to take a closer look at some of the things in this package, and one thing that was not. Senator Coons, we appreciate you taking some time to join us today. Thanks for being with us.
It's always good to be on with you, Tom.
So the $1,400 direct payments, unemployment benefits, minimum wage got a lot of the attention as this bill was debated. But obviously, there's a lot more to this bill, and I want to delve into some of that and what it means for Delawareans. Starting with the money for vaccines and vaccine distribution, how quickly can that money get out and address issues of supply and equitable distribution that we've seen early in the vaccine rollout here in Delaware?
Well, Tom, the good news is that vaccines are getting out now more and more quickly. I've heard from Delawareans complaints and concerns about how can they get access, how can they get vaccinated. And as the volume of vaccines being manufactured and distributed has already improved, the number of Delawareans getting vaccinated has increased. We're up to 2 million Americans being vaccinated every day. And we're getting to an impressive percentage of Delawareans who've had their first shot. But we've got a long way to go. I think we will see in the next month to 6 weeks a robust, even abundant supply of vaccines. But as you indicated, at that point, the question will be overcoming vaccine hesitancy, doing outreach, active outreach, which is going to require people making the effort, doing engagement with folks in the grassroots level and communities that for whatever reason are not excited about and volunteering to take this vaccine. That's going to be the hard work of late spring and early summer, making sure that we can get not just 30 or 40% of Delawareans vaccinated, but 70 or 80% so that we can reach that point where the pandemic genuinely begins to end.
So you feel like the hesitancy is a big part of what's fueling the issues with equity and distribution?
Yes. I've had conversations with healthcare leaders, with civic leaders, with religious leaders, and there are a variety of reasons. Some folks feel this vaccine was approved too quickly, or they're suspicious of the Trump administration or the conditions under which it was developed. Others, particularly Black Americans and Delawareans, have historic and understandable concerns about the history of vaccines. Others, for some reason, think that vaccines can be dangerous or harmful. None of that is true. These vaccines have been thoroughly and appropriately tested. I've been vaccinated. Many other leaders in our community have been vaccinated. It is safe, and it is the only reasonable way that we can get out of this pandemic.
There's also a significant chunk of money to reopen schools. That addresses, obviously, reopening them safely, but also the learning loss that many kids have faced with schools closed. How important is it to get at that second part, the learning loss and the disproportionate impact that that has had on some communities?
That's a big part of this bill, and that's a big priority for President Biden. As we all know, Dr. Biden, his wife, is an educator. He's been really focused on this as a priority, helping get schools reopened, making sure we address the homework gap, the broadband and access to remote learning. There's still going to be remote learning going on for some time. And frankly, this is an opportunity for us to invest in connectivity in ways that will make it easier for children in families that don't have broadband or don't have computers to participate in learning going forward. There's also going to be some investment in national service in the AmeriCorps program that will particularly target this challenge about learning loss and distance learning. And there's $160 billion that's going to go to schools and to institutions nationwide that help with schools and school programming.
The package also includes more money for small businesses and nonprofits, and in particular the hard-hit restaurant industry. Is the hope here that specifically for restaurants that this isn't a case of the cavalry arriving too late?
Well, it is a challenge. We've lost tens of thousands of businesses that will not reopen. So the PPP program, which I helped co-author and support on the Small Business Committee, has kept lots of businesses afloat. But frankly, most of the restaurant owners I've talked to have run through their first PPP loan, which has become a grant in many cases. They've applied for it, are hoping to get their second. But hospitality got hammered in particular. That is one segment that has really had a challenge in the economic downturn because of the closures. So I'm hopeful that the $25 billion that's in this, that is specifically targeted to restaurants, will help ensure that those that can recover do, that those who can survive will, but also provide support for folks more broadly in the industry, so that if you used to work for a restaurant that isn't going to reopen, there will be others where you could get employed as the economy reopens.
It is a very big bill. Are there some other provisions in it that you see that are particularly noteworthy for Delawareans and how this state will get out of the pandemic?
Well, two things. One, there was a program under Obama, the SSBCI, that provided grants to businesses in states to help with economic expansion. That's being renewed. There's $10 billion for small state-led business lending and investment programs. I'm excited about that. There's also a child tax credit that's going to be robust and is going to help lift children out of poverty. Those two haven't gotten much attention because they're a little more technical. Last, something that I've been excited about, there's $1 billion to expand national service, the AmeriCorps program. Altogether, Tom, I think this is a robust, bold bill that will make a dramatic difference, get us out of the pandemic and jumpstart our economy to a point where 6 months from now, I think the American economy will be roaring forward.
You mentioned that child tax credit, and my understanding is that that is a temporary change to that tax credit. Are you hopeful that that will be something that will stick long term?
Well, I'm optimistic that once we see the impact on American families, it'll gain longer term support.
Is there lingering disappointment on your behalf of this package getting no support from Republicans?
Yes. I walked around the floor of the Senate during the very, very long night and morning that we were here voting on it, and talked to a dozen Republican colleagues about other priorities that we might work on going forward. Things like immigration, continuing to expand national service, gun background checks, clean water. I have a whole series of bipartisan bills I'm looking to introduce now, because, frankly, this was a bill that we could do with 50 votes. Those other topics are things that we need bipartisanship to address, and I'm hopeful that in the coming months you'll see legislation moving forward that's genuinely bipartisan.
Is minimum wage also on that list? You were among those who did not vote to include minimum wage increase in this bill, but you said you are committed to raising it. Is it realistic that there's going to be enough support found from the GOP to do a standalone minimum wage bill?
Well, we have to increase the federal minimum wage. $7.25 is far too low. It's been allowed to decrease over a decade in its buying power. The most important part of that bill, which I strongly support, is indexing the minimum wage so that it steadily goes up every year. And I do think there's going to be bipartisan support to raise it. There's a bill in the Delaware General Assembly that would raise it to $11 an hour. And I think that's the kind of level that we could get broad bipartisan support to move towards quickly. Even the Sanders bill didn't raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour for four more years to 2025. I think some of the resistance in my caucus was to doing it right now in the middle of a pandemic. I'm committed to working to get a minimum wage bill passed, whether it happens in a bipartisan way or whether it happens later this year through a second reconciliation bill. We'll get that done this year.
Thanks to Senator Chris Coons for his time on The Green this week. Next up on The Green, we check in with Delaware's senior senator, Tom Carper, about the COVID relief bill and other issues he's working on in Congress. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last segment, we heard from Delaware's junior senator, Chris Coons, about the $1.9 trillion federal COVID relief package and not including a minimum wage increase in that package. Now we turn to the state's senior senator, Tom Carper, to get his thoughts on voting not to include a minimum wage increase in that package, as well as a number of other issues he's working on Capitol Hill. Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia met up with Senator Carper earlier this week to pick his brain about what's happening in Washington.
Do you think that everything got through in that stimulus package that you wanted to get through?
No, I think we need to come back and raise the minimum wage. I think we need to do it in ways that acknowledge that we're in the midst of the worst recession since the Great Depression, and that there are millions, probably hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of businesses that are gone and won't be coming back, and we need to make sure that we listen to them as what they need. And I'm not a stranger to the minimum wage. When I was governor, I think we raised the minimum wage two or three times. We started, I think, below the national average and the federal wage. And when I finished, we were about a dollar above the federal average. The key is to raise it not at the bottom of the worst recession since the Great Depression, but at a time when the economy is coming back. The economy is going to be coming back. It's going to be coming back later this year. And we need to come back and revisit this. And I think we'll do that and pass a minimum wage. $15 by 2025 is probably where we'll end up and should end up. There, I have a couple of concerns that led me to not vote for the proposal that was before us last week. One, it was did not listen at all. It was not sensitive at all to the small businesses in this country. They say, look, we're on our back. We're going out of business. We've been out of business. Listen to us and do this in a way that is sensitive to our needs, too. Number two, we have a lot of people who are the folks that are disabled. They participate in special programs and Goodwill programs, among others. We want to make sure that they don't lose their Medicaid by raising the minimum wage in a way that knocks them out of eligibility for Medicaid. We want to make sure that the support systems that those that are disabled and working for places like Goodwill, that they don't lose the support systems that they need in order to be able to continue to work. We can address those needs. We can address the concerns of the small businesses that are struggling not to go under, that are struggling to come back, and make sure that folks have access, who are disabled, have access to Medicaid, to health care. After we raise the minimum wage, make sure that those same folks have access to supportive services that will enable them to continue to work. Mm-hmm. We can do that. If we can do that, we can do it in a bipartisan way. I think we'll do it this year, and we should.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask. You were one of the 10 Democratic senators who voted against it. That was really your reason, was that you don't think it's right to raise the minimum wage in the middle of this economic recession.
Well, when I was governor, we raised the minimum wage several times. We raised it when in the strongest economy since the Great Depression. Right now, we're in the worst economy since the Great Depression. And later this year, I expect the economy is going to be strengthening, getting stronger. People, businesses being created, businesses coming back to life. That's the time to raise it.
Some proponents would say that, minimum wage is already too low, the federal minimum wage.
And,
raising it is not bringing it too high. It's bringing it to the right level right now.
Yeah, and we will. We're going to do this. We're going to do it, I think, the right way. We're going to do it in ways that make sure that folks who are disabled, for example, that they don't lose their Medicaid or access to Medicaid. We want to make sure they don't lose their access to supportive services, and they can keep working. We can do that, and we'll do that this year.
You have some other bills that are kind of out. I know that you introduced your D.C. statehood bill. Tell me a little bit about that. What's kind of the push there? Do you think there's a chance that that could get through this year?
It's been an uphill fight, but it's a fight worth fighting. For me, it's an equity matter. There are more people that live in Washington, D.C. than live in several states. They pay taxes. On a per capita basis, they pour more taxes than probably half the states in the country. They serve our country. They serve in military. They risk their lives. And somehow although they pay taxes, and although they do all that, they don't have somebody to vote for them in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. It's just not fair. We fought a Revolutionary War, over 200 years ago, over the issue of taxation without representation. The folks in Washington, D.C. pay their fair share of taxes, maybe more than their fair share of taxes. They don't have representation. They deserve that.
Mm-hmm. You've introduced this a couple of times before, right?
I have.
Yeah. Has there ever been any like major changes to it? Have you made changes or concessions to try and get more votes for it?
Actually, we really haven't had to change much. This is an idea whose time is going to come. And each year we get closer and closer. We have more and more co-sponsors, the same in the House of Representatives. And I'm encouraged that as a matter of fairness and equity, that this will ultimately be enacted.
And then I was looking at H.R. 1, the voting rights bill that was passed in the House. I'm wondering if you know anything about that.
Not much, no. Okay. Well, let me just say, with respect to voting rights, the right to vote, to choose our leaders, is a basic cornerstone, a building block for democracy. If we don't have that, we don't really have a democracy. And I grew up in Danville, Virginia. My sister and I, born in West Virginia, grew up in Danville, Virginia, the last capital of the Confederacy. We saw voter suppression up front and personal. And as people were denied the right to register, poll taxes, intelligence taxes, and stuff like that, were just awful. They were designed just to keep black people from voting. And we're seeing it's the same theme, different ways to do it, but we're seeing the same thing that my sister and I saw 50 years ago as kids growing up in the last couple of the Confederacy, Danville, Virginia.
And obviously a lot of these things like HR1 and voting rights and other things are going to need a lot more support if they're going to get past the filibuster, and that's been a real big blocker. I didn't know what your opinion was on, you know, the filibuster and getting rid of that so you can get some of this legislation passed.
Yeah, we think of a filibuster, and I, when I was a kid growing up and studying civics and all in high school, we thought of the filibuster as somebody has to stand up, and then whether it's in the House of Representatives or the Senate, and speak and filibuster. And that's not really the way it works. Like, we can go into quorum calls and stop speaking. My own view is the idea of a filibuster should be more like a talking and a speaking and standing filibuster, not just you speak for a few minutes and then, you know, hit the pause button and go away for a couple of hours. That's not the way a filibuster should be.
Mm-hmm. I think Joe Manchin said the same thing, that he thinks he doesn't want to get rid of the filibuster altogether, but bring it back to the
talking,
you need to talk as much as you
filibuster.
As long as you can. So you think that's the way we should go?
I think that's probably where we should go. I think that's probably where we will go.
And I don't know if there was any other major bills that you've kind of been pushing through or trying to get passed that you wanted to highlight.
The big focus that we have in this Congress is going to be climate change, global warming, crazy weather that we're seeing. How do we address that in ways that create economic opportunity and jobs? And there's a broad bipartisan consent on putting together a service transportation, roads, highways, bridges, infrastructure legislation, water infrastructure legislation, and the deployment of access to the internet across the country. In a lot of rural areas, a lot of urban areas don't have access to the internet. Got a lot of kids trying to go to school in a home where they don't have access to the internet. That's not working so good. So those three are service transportation, roads, highways, bridges, water, wastewater, and access to the internet. Three big job creators, three things will make our country stronger and connect us.
So a lot of climate change stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. And then one thing that I almost forgot was, obviously the stimulus bill was really, really big. Do you think this is going to be the last coronavirus relief bill that we'll see?
I hope so. I think the key to the latest stimulus bill, and frankly to the early ones as well, is to fund, initially was to fund research into vaccines that would actually stop the virus. And once we came up with the cures to be able to ramp up the production and began vaccinating people in great numbers. We're now coming to the point where we're not yet awash in the vaccines, but my hope is AstraZeneca, which is actually headquartered here in Wilmington, Delaware, that they'll get FDA approval next month, in the month of April, and bring their capacity of producing tens of millions of vaccines a month to what is already out there, and that, God willing, by the end of April, we will be awash in vaccines in this country, and well on our way to putting this COVID pandemic in our rearview mirror. I think it's just around the corner. If we can get one more big breakthrough with AstraZeneca, I think the worst will be behind us.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Wonderful to see you.
Thanks to Senator Tom Carper and our Roman Battaglia for their time on The Green this week. We'll take a quick break now, and when The Green returns, we'll have Arts Playlist and a preview of a new exhibition at the Delaware Art Museum. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A new exhibition opens this weekend at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington. Collecting and Connecting, Recent Acquisitions, 2010 through 2020, samples the last 10 years' worth of additions to the museum's collection while offering a behind-the-scenes look at how it builds that collection. And on this week's Arts Playlist, the museum's in-house curator, Margareta Frederick, joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to offer a preview.
Hey, let's talk about, before we talk about this new exhibit, give me some background about your work that you do at the Delaware Art Museum.
Well, I'm a curator. I specialize particularly in the Pre-Raphaelite collection, which is our collection of British art from the Victorian period. But we have three collecting strengths, actually four, British Pre-Raphaelites, American art, 1830s, to 1960, contemporary art, and American illustration.
All right, so now we're getting ready for this new exhibition to go on display March 13th through September 12th. Again, it's called Collecting and Connecting, Recent Acquisitions, 2010 to 2020. Tell me all about it and take all the time you need.
Well, to be honest, the exhibition came about largely due to COVID. When COVID hit a year ago last March, the exhibitions we had planned pretty much all got canceled in one way or another, largely because the art world shut down. We couldn't borrow from any other institutions. We couldn't lend to any other institutions. So we needed to design an exhibition that was largely drawn from our permanent collection, so no loans necessary. And this is what we came up with. It's a wonderful way to stop and take stock of what we've been purchasing, acquiring, or being given for the last decade, a nice opportunity to see if there's some patterns which emerge, as you would suspect. Because we have very much made an emphasis on this, the large body of this work, over 1,500 works of art, is either by women or artists of color. The largest growing collection is our contemporary art collection, of which of those 1,500 plus works of art, contemporary makes up about 700.
So, as you said, the museum's recent acquisitions span centuries, styles, cultures, and mediums, and now call the Delaware Art Museum home. And through this new exhibition, Collecting and Connecting, visitors are being invited to sample the last 10 years' additions to the collection. So if we come, walk us through what can visitors expect to see?
Well, It's interesting. It's a bit of a challenge, curatorial, to put together works of art that range in date from the 1830s to 2020 and are representing two countries on two different continents. So we really had to think carefully about how we were going to put these works together and make some kind of a cohesive story. We went through a series of iterations, including broad thematic arrangements and so on, before, in our kind of defeat at the various ways that weren't clearly going to work, we came to the answer, which was simply to focus on looking, emphasizing relationships between works of varied period styles and genre that were not necessarily visible in our normally sort of segregated pen.
What do you think will be the most popular? I don't want you to single out any one, but what do you think will be the most popular with visitors?
That's interesting because what we did is to make these kind of visual associations with these rather disparate works of art in the hope that visitors would come and sort of see those connections and indeed make some of their own without any prior need of great knowledge of art history, but simply to focus on, looking, because of course art is so personal and interpretive and everyone brings something different to any given work of art, which affects how they see it. So each individual's understanding or vision is different, and that of course is what makes art so powerful. It's also the basis for dialogue. You know, what you see and I see is quite different. But nonetheless, it provokes a kind of a conversation. So there'll be works of art that people might be familiar with, but there'll be works that have not yet even been on view. So there'll be surprises and there'll be some old friends, and those will be some interesting combinations.
Talk about some of the works that people could be familiar with.
Let's see. Familiar would be some of the pre-Raphaelite works, which we put on a rotation, some of the landscapes, which are works on paper and don't get out much on a regular basis, but filter through every couple of months. So, for instance, a lovely landscape by the younger brother of John Everett Millais called Cokesbury. There is a wonderful digital print by Fred Comegys, and of course people will be familiar with Fred Comegys. He was a reporter for many, many decades for the Wilmington News Journal.
As soon as you said that name, I was like, I know that name. Where do I know that name?
Exactly. Yeah, there are several digital sea prints. They're kind of photographs of work that was done by a contemporary artist named Nina Katchadourian, who had a wonderful show about 5 or 6 years ago based on books in our library. Some Andy Wyeth, a Mary Page Evans. These are all kind of some local favorites. There's a lovely work that people may not have seen very early, done when she was quite young, by Helen Farr Sloan, the wife of Ashcan School painter John Sloan.
Wow. This is going to be a great exhibit. Just to let people know, we are talking to Margareta Frederick. She is an in-house curator for a new exhibition going up soon at the Delaware Art Museum. It's called Collecting and Connecting Recent Acquisitions 2010 to 2020. It'll go on view from March 13th to September 12th. What gallery will this be in?
We have a large gallery which we use for temporary exhibitions. It's the Fusco Exhibition Gallery. It's where people who have been to the museum before will be familiar in finding temporary exhibitions. It's about 100-plus works of art that will be in this exhibition, maybe a little less, maybe a little more.
Wow, I can't wait to see this. This should be great. What else do you want people to know about this upcoming exhibition?
Come with no preconceived notions and ready to look. There's just some wonderful surprises that happen when you put works of art together that wouldn't be seen in that way.
I was going to say, early on in this conversation, you said this all came about because of COVID. Explain that a little bit more.
Well, let's see. You know, in March, everyone was, you know, put into some sort of restrictions in terms of going out. And museums basically shut down, and their staffs were either simply sent home or furloughed. And because of that, we couldn't work with other museums. And many of our shows, as in every museum, require works to be borrowed or loaned to other institutions. So when that basically stopped, we realized that we would have to proceed forward with some kind of a plan that was what we refer to in-house as COVID-proof. And the best thing to, way to do that, to ensure that, was to work entirely from our permanent collection. And because we didn't know how long COVID was going to go on, it had to be a show that could stay up for a significant amount of time. It didn't need to go back to whoever owned it. And if it's ours, then that is not a problem. But at the same time, not knowing when things would open up again, it needed to be interesting. So of course, that's how we came upon this.
Yeah, and COVID, of course, is still ongoing. How is the museum doing, though?
Well, like most public institutions, we have visitorship that is limited. We're, you know, only allowed to have a certain capacity at any one time. Many of our programs have gone virtual. So that's the other kind of standard way we've dealt with this. But it's very interesting. There's been some bright spots that have came. We've become much more agile and certainly better at virtual programming.
Margaretta, I'm going to give you final words. Anything I'm not asking you that you definitely want the general public, visitors, our listeners to know about collecting and connecting recent acquisitions 2010 to 2020?
Be prepared for surprises.
Thanks to the Delaware Art Museum's in-house curator, Margaretta Frederick, and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. Collecting and Connecting, Recent Acquisitions, 2010 through 2020, runs from March 13th through September 12th. And we finish out this week's show with Enlighten Me, and an update on the University of Delaware's salt marsh research, looking at their impact on carbon in the atmosphere. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we bring you more on the science of salt marshes. Salt marshes are tidal wetlands that line much of Delaware's coast. They're often thought of as a sink for global warming causing carbon. But researchers at the University of Delaware are challenging this understanding. A study published in January took a different approach to measuring the movement of greenhouse gases in and out of a salt marsh, and I found something surprising. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks again with UD professor in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, Rodrigo Vargas, about the research he co-authored.
Dr. Vargas, we've covered research by you and another UD researcher, Dr. Angelia Seifert, that found unexpectedly high levels of methane stored in the sediments of a Delaware salt marsh. This is important because, like CO2, methane is a greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming, except it's actually more potent in terms of its heat-trapping ability than carbon. Now, in this more recent study, you set out to look at how methane fluxes, or basically the movement of methane in and out of an ecosystem, corresponds with different metabolic phases in plants, things like greenout and dormancy. And again, you found something that goes against the established thinking around salt marshes. So talk to me a bit about these metabolic phases of the plants. What are the plants doing, and why might this change where the methane is stored?
So I am an ecosystem ecologist, and as an ecosystem ecologist, I'm interested in understanding the exchanges of mass and energy on ecosystems. And to do that, we really want to figure out what is controlling these fluxes or ecosystem processes. And to do that, there are many ways and many questions that you can ask. So one of the questions specifically for this new study was, well, how much the ecosystem is breathing in terms of CO2 and methane? And also, when they are breathing the CO2 and the methane? Are they breathing more early in the year, later in the year, or during the growing season? So to do this, we use a phenocam. A phenocam is a webcam that basically takes pictures of the ecosystem every half an hour. So we literally take pictures of how the grass grows. That may not be super exciting to many people, but when you take these pictures constantly, you actually can see literally how the grass grows or how the plants grow, and that is beautiful. You can also extract information from the colors that you are taking. We call it a greenness index. And with that new index, you can calculate inflection points. What is an inflection point? It's simply when a curve is changing and is going up or is going down. And with that information, we can calculate when would be a different phase, a different moment of development of the plants. Green up or dormancy or the maturity phases. And we can quantify how the ecosystem is greening up. And knowing these stages, then we can calculate how much CO2 and methane is breathing or capturing from the atmosphere into the ecosystem.
So the really interesting takeaway of your research is that the study area in this salt marsh is actually a net carbon source to the atmosphere. So what does that mean?
Yeah, that is really interesting. So when we see these pictures and we see that the ecosystem is greening and is growing, we will assume that the ecosystem is capturing CO2, is capturing carbon into the ecosystem. And this is very important because salt marshes are ecosystems that provide many environmental services for storm protection, for habitat. These ecosystems can be seen as filters for nutrients to prevent nutrients going into the coastal ocean directly. But they also serve as important carbon sinks. Usually plants will grow, they fix carbon via photosynthesis, and with that, they build biomass. That biomass, the plants, the leaves, the twigs, is deposited into the sediments in the soils. But these soils have something that is very special and make them different. These ecosystems are, or these soils are water saturated and therefore create anoxic conditions. So conditions of low oxygen. So because of that, and also because there are biochemical conditions such as high salinity content, this is not the best place to be a microbe and to be eating fast and decomposing that organic matter. Therefore, that organic matter, that biomass, it just decomposes slower than in other ecosystems. And the net result of that is accumulation of organic matter, accumulation of the biomass, that ultimately leads to higher carbon stocks in the sediments. That's the reason. Now, biomass can also be eaten by the microbes from different ways, not only via aerobic metabolism. But if they have low oxygen, then there are other ways that they can access that organic matter. And the byproduct, what they will be breathing, is not CO2, it's going to be methane. So usually it's expected that these ecosystems are great carbon sinks, great places where we can absorb a lot of atmospheric carbon. But if we measure another important part of the carbon cycle, then the story may be different. And that is with the methane. The other part is that we usually do work during the growing season. And during the growing season is when everything is active, when the plants are active, you know, everything is growing. With this study that we were talking about, we were able to measure also the fluxes during the winter. And this is very interesting because if we walk to these ecosystems in the winter, we just see dead grasses. Nothing is green, nothing is happening, or apparently nothing is happening. And even my father-in-law tells me, why are you studying this? Everything is dead. Well, we were able to measure all these fluxes throughout the winter. And what we found is that during the winter time, what we call this dormancy period of the plants, we have high emissions of CO2 and also relatively high emissions of methane. So when we do the sum up of all the CO2 emissions and all the emissions of methane, we end up with a different story. And the different story is that these ecosystems are net carbon sources, or at least could be net carbon sources for the years that we measure them.
So does this mean that we should fill our salt marshes, try to replace them with something like forests, or should we just build houses on them?
Wow, that's a great question. So this doesn't mean that salt marshes are bad ecosystems, that they are pollutants. Not at all. Not at all. We usually think that when there are CO2 emissions or methane emissions, we associate that with pollution. But natural ecosystems, they have a delicate balance between uptake and release. The cost of not protecting these ecosystems and changing them into something like an urban land or a parking lot, the cost could be very, very, very high in terms of environmental services. For example, if we just remove all that carbon that is stored there that we were talking about, and suddenly we expose it into oxygen, basically what you will be doing is creating a party for all these microbes. It's going to a buffet. Yeah, it's food that it was not accessible to these microbes. Now it's going to be accessible, and all that carbon that was stored there is just going to be their food for these microbes, and all that is just going to go back quickly to the atmosphere. So that is a big mistake in terms of carbon. But also, you are removing all the other environmental services that are we were talking about for these ecosystems. Now, this study only covered 2 years of measurements. We didn't measure before, and we are continuing measuring now. But this insight, what we learned is just insights about what happened during these 2 years. So what we learned is that in these 2 years, this ecosystem was a net source of carbon to the atmosphere. Is this ecosystem going to continue to be a net source or a net sink in the following years? We don't know. We have this information that there were carbon sources under these conditions. If the weather conditions changes, for example, if it's a warmer year or a wetter year, or we have an influence of a storm, or we have other effects, that may have a different response to the ecosystem. So this information helps managers to understand how ecosystems respond under certain conditions. And the more information we have, we can learn and make informed decisions to protect these ecosystems to the benefit for society and for the environment.
Dr. Rodrigo Vargas, Associate Professor in UD's College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks, Sophia, for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. Stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible: Delaware Public Media's Roman Battalion, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them, and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.